Right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Hoosier Hockey Live, episode 17, featuring the Saskatoon native, 29-year-old retired vet, an ECHL veteran of 140 games. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show that is brought to you by All Black Hockey Sticks, Mr. Rhett Bly. Rhett, thanks for being with us, brother.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. All right, man, let's go ahead and dive in. I want to go right from the beginning, man. Looks like the Weyburn Red Wings of the Saskatoon Junior Hockey League. Is that right?
Yeah. So leaving midget hockey, I kind of had the opportunity to potentially go out of province.
Uh-huh.
So in Canada, the way it works is when you're kind of protected by your own province until you turn 18 years old. And then once you turn 18, I was actually still 17 at the time when I left for Weyburn, but it was that playing year. So I had the opportunity to go out to British Columbia, which generally mm-hmm. is the province that generates the most college scholarships. But my dad and I went and checked out a Weyburn Red Wings game during the playoffs before the year I was going to slated to go there, and the coach came up and he sat in stands with us during warm-ups and pretty much just said, you know, we'd be really lucky to have you on our team next year. We're looking forward to bringing you into Weyburn. And just the way, you know, he was a 35-year veteran coach in the league, and mm-hmm. that following year he actually became the third coach to have 1,000 wins in any league.
Wow.
So he joined Scotty Bowman and Brian Kilray of the Ottawa 67, so he was the third one to mm-hmm. do it. So you know, just to have somebody with that much experience in hockey kind of, you know, take the time out of his day before one of his playoff games to come and give you 5-10 minutes of just like some recruiting time. So it wasn't the reason I ended up going to Weyburn, but it ended up mm-hmm. being something pretty cool that led to that decision.
Right on. Well, in Weyburn, you spent 3 years there, had 164 games in the SJ, and scored 182 points by way of 74 goals and 108 assists with 112 PIMs. So just kind of talk about your juniors experience and the development side and you know, how you took that coaching and all that and applied that to your game, you know, during that time.
Yeah, so the city of Weyburn, it's a small city. It's about 10,000 people, and it's one of those towns where the Red Wings is kind of the big ticket item in town.
Mm-hmm.
So like every door, you know, all the convenience stores, restaurants, they all say, have little stickers on that say push for the Red Wings, pull for the Red Wings. So it's like kind of one of those towns where everybody just rallies behind the team.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real small town feel. Everybody kind of knows everybody, and then the hockey team kind of gets put on a little bit of a pedestal. So it was a real cool experience in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't necessarily have, you know, the best start to my time there. So like I kind of mentioned before, I was 17 when I moved to Weyburn. It was the first time really moving away from home, which, you know, 17 isn't like it's that young to be moving away.
Right.
I know like a lot of hockey players, they move out when they're 15, you know, sometimes even younger, you know, with, they go live with billet families. So,
right.
During training camp, it was my first year, and we were supposed to have a really strong team, and there were about, you know, 3 or 4 spots available. But at training camp, any junior team, they would bring in, you know, 70 guys to training camp, and then kind of whittle it down after the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And the team took their time kind of making their roster, so we had a lot of extra guys hanging around town. And I'm not too sure what the reasoning behind this was, but you know, after the first week or so, I was assigned a billet family, but it was a temporary billet family. So
right.
Most players were moving into their houses. The veteran players who probably lived there for the past 2 or 3 years moved back with the families that they were living with. So we're in about the middle of September now, and I end up with the family was great. They've been longtime billet family, but they had about 5 players staying in their house.
Oh man!
So like players are staying on couches, players are staying, you know, on sofas in the basement, and they kind of ran out of space, and it was the only room they had was in their, you know, like portable trailer that they had in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So So there's no electricity, no heat or anything.
Sheesh.
And this is Saskatchewan here. It gets pretty cold in
sure
in September. So at night I would be sleeping in like two pairs of jeans and and like a sweatshirt. So
unreal.
So it was off to a bit of a cold start there. I ended up spending a lot of time with one of the rookies who he already had his fill family. So I spent a lot of my time at their place and just kind of during the day and stuff like that, just because I didn't really know like where I kind of fit in.
Mm-hmm.
So it just so happens that she actually was also, she worked in the front office for the team, the billet mom.
Mm-hmm.
So after a while she was like, hey, you know, Carter, like why is Rhett spending so much time here? Like what's going on here? and so my buddy, he kind of explained to her my living situation. She was like, Jesus, like, we gotta get him out of there. So like, right. I moved into their house for a few days, and then essentially I, you know, ultimately landed with some extended family friends.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the best build situation ever. These are some of the nicest people I've ever met. And
sure,
welcoming into their home. So it was great.
Right on.
But that was kind of my first 5 weeks of junior hockey and the introduction I had. So I was. It was tough.
Right on. Now, when you were playing juniors, did they pay billets like they do here in like the USHL and NHL?
Yeah, it would be the exact same.
So oh, okay.
The families get taken care of.
To buy food for you guys.
Yeah, to provide food and
right
you on. Know. I don't think that it wouldn't be something they would make a lot of money. They would do it as like.
Sure.
You know, to have some, you know, maybe a role model for younger kids or
right.
maybe they're hockey fans and they just want to be close to the game.
Mm-hmm.
I know in my situation, it was, you know, we had known the people for years. It just so happened that, you know, they were friends of friends and we
uh-huh.
grew to be very, very close with them. So.
Right on. Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, you mentioned maybe one of the tougher memories. What's your favorite memory when you were in Weyburn?
Favorite memory? So I was on probably one of the best lines in Weyburn in the Saskatchewan League
mm-hmm.
over the past, you know, at the time it was probably, you know, between a 5 or 6 year span, we were probably the best line in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a lot of fun playing with these two guys that were two of my closest friends. And, we just had a lot of chemistry out there. We actually almost all three of us ended up going to the same school together. So,
mm-hmm.
It was a lot of fun playing with those guys. I guess there's just a lot of memories to have, just like big games and
mm-hmm.
You know, nothing too specific jumps out. I know the whole recruiting process and going through, you know, where you're looking at going to school and stuff. It's, you know, I spent pretty much my full 18, 19 year old year being recruited by different schools, and I think it was a really flattering time just having these coaches reach
sure.
out to you and tell you the things that they like about you and trying to get you to come to school. So it was, you know, a lot of really good memories in that time.
Right on. All right, man. Notable names while you were there. Was it a big league with big names, or was it kind of smaller and you just kind of had to be a diamond in the rough situation?
I would say more of the latter, but we did have some pretty big names that kind of went through the league. Probably the biggest name that most people would recognize would be Jaden Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of his 16-year-old year before he ended up going to move on to play in the USHL with, I think, Tri-City, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
I think he went to Tri-City, but he was there for a year, and he was an absolute stud. He was playing with his older brother, Rylan, and they were on the line together, and they were pretty dominant, so.
Sure.
I'd say Jaden was probably the biggest.
Right on, man. Yeah, you know, big names, you know, Canada's one of those, you know, spots where you don't necessarily have to come from a huge city, you know, to have a big opportunity, and, you know, looking at his profile right now, it looks like, you know, that exact situation where maybe he, you know, started off in something lower and got noticed. And next thing you know, bang, he's, you know, with the Tri-City Storm and then ended up going to Colorado College and then, you know, picked up by St. Louis. So, you know, definitely a doable situation. So, I'm going to give you a quick little 90-second break. I'm going to do a quick ad read, brother.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, guys, one of the big sponsors of Hoosier Hockey Live, we're so blessed to have them, is All Black Hockey Sticks. If you go to allblackhockeysticks.com, you can check out all of their the lines that they have, whether you're a senior player, have an intermediate size, or a junior size stick that you swing. All Black Hockey Sticks has a stick for you out there. They've got multiple curves, multiple lies, multiple weights of sticks. They've got everything for my tall ass that's 71 inches long, that stick, all the way down to something that a five-year-old could swing, you know, in a house league. So go to allblackhockeysticks.com, check it out. They've got great products. They've got more than just sticks. They've got, you know, beer wax that we're giving away here this week. And they've got the wraparounds for your stick that don't tear them up when you're practicing. So, again, that's allblackhockeysticks.com. They've also got just hockey jerseys as well. You know, another company that's partnered with them. Go online. It's tournament season here in Indianapolis. So go online, get your artwork to them, and they'll crank out some awesome jerseys for you guys as well. A company that, you know, I've used on several different occasions, a great company, and nothing I wouldn't endorse without using myself. So check it out, allblackhockeysticks.com. Rhett, we're back with you, brother.
Nice.
All right, man, so go into the transition here. I mean, you played 3 years in junior, and then you got recruited, and you were selected Merrimack. Out east. So kind of just give us that process and how that all went down.
Yeah, for sure. So it was during my, I guess I made the total decision in the spring of 2019 to go to Merrimack. At the time, at that point I had a number of different schools, some of them a lot more interested than others. I pretty much narrowed it down to about three or four schools that I was, you know, really heavily considering. And I did my official school visit to Merrimack College. I was being recruited at the time by a guy named Darren Yopik, who ended up leaving Merrimack to go get a head coaching job in the BCHL. And then ultimately now he's a scout for the Minnesota Wild. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I really connected with him. He was a really smart guy, and he, I just kind of liked his view on recruiting and kind of where he was looking for success and, mm-hmm. and what kind of values he saw in different players. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately on that recruiting trip, I met a bunch of the guys, and you know, if you ever talk to a guy who's done a recruiting trip, they treat you really well and they take you out and you have a lot of fun. So. I know when I went, it was in the spring, so it was out of season for the guys, so they were enjoying themselves a little bit more than they probably would in the season. I actually stayed with another guy from Saskatchewan, there's a guy from Chicago, and then a couple of local guys, and then kind of in the mix were a guy who had just signed his entry-level deal with San Jose after his sophomore year. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, a few other of the guys were kind of lingering around as well. So mm-hmm. it was middle of the week, but we had some fun. We were had a few beers, and we kind of burnt the candle at both ends for a couple nights, and mm-hmm. I really enjoyed myself and had the opportunity to meet the coaching staff and kind of tour the campus. And at the time, Merrimack they weren't doing too well as a program. But the head coach, Mark Denny, he basically said, hey, we have a freshman coming in next year. He's a French player, so he's first player in school history from France, and he's going to change the face of this program. This guy's name is Stefan DaCosta. Mm-hmm. He ended up playing 2 years at Merrimack and then ended up signing with the Ottawa Senators and kind of was up and down for a little bit, and now he's a KHL All-Star. Mm-hmm. But I remember, you know, his pitch to me was, you know, you can be part of, you know, building out a smaller program, and you can, you know, really, you know, leave your impact somewhere. Or, you know, you can look at, you know, some of the bigger schools and, you know, maybe, you know, you have some success there, but you know, you could just be another brick in the wall. And that's the kind of, you know, the way he painted that picture for me was like, I really believed in what he was saying. And, you know, the opportunity was there for me to be a part of something. And I really felt like I got that opportunity. So, not only did I have, you know, a really good time with all the guys and meshed well with them, it felt like a good fit with the coaching staff as well. So it was kind of like, I had a couple other opportunities to go visit some schools. And I just, as soon as I got back, I just kind of told my parents, hey, that's where I want to go. Like, you know, it's just off the North Shore of Boston. Boston's an unbelievable city. I, you know, that's where I want to be. So it was really quick afterwards. I made the commitment and ultimately I got to, the other big selling point was I got to go back and spend another year in Weyburn. So I love my time in Weyburn. So had I, you know, chosen a different school and went right away, I would have missed out on that last year in Weyburn. So it was really just the perfect storm of everything I was looking for in terms of Merrimack.
Right on. Were you guys pretty solid at Merrimack your freshman year?
Yeah, so my freshman year was probably our best year. And I, you know, I talked about Steph, but we had other amazing players on our team as well. But Steph was probably the best college hockey player, or at least one of the top three, I would say, that I had seen in my time. He could do things with the puck. He could slow the game down. He was, I don't know, it was like, there's no other way to describe it than it was like an NHL player playing with like might hockey. If he wanted to change the course of a game, he could with a snap of his fingers. There was one time we were in Nashville and we were playing, Alabama Huntsville. And, and I think we were down like 4-2 or something going into the third. And Coach Denny walks in the room and he just, because we were having a hell of a season and we were going to be in the national tournament that year. So we're down to Alabama, Huntsville, and Huntsville had like 2 or 3 wins all year. So if you lose against them, it pretty much kills your season.
Right.
Just because the way the pairwise works and everything like that.
Sure.
A loss to a team that's, you know, at the bottom of the league, it's going to drop you down the standings and it's just too hard to overcome late in the year. So.
Right.
He comes in the locker room and he just says, "Hey, if you guys lose this game, you know, your season's done. Like you miss out on the NCAA tournament."
Right.
So Steph isn't gonna let that happen. So
sure.
He just changes the course of the game, and sure enough, we win, and then we play him the next day, and I think we beat them like 7-1 or something. So. Mm.
Yeah, I was looking at his line here. 33 games played that year, 14-31 for 45.
Mm-hmm.
Unreal.
Yeah, and you know what? Even, like, as far as points are concerned, the points don't really do it justice. Like, I know it said 14 goals. There's a lot of guys that score 14 goals in college hockey.
Yeah.
Just the way Steph did it on a team that was a defense-first mentality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not too sure how familiar you are with, like, the Hockey East in general.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, there's a lot of good players that come through there.
Sure.
It's, you know, so that year we lost to Boston College in a Hockey East championship game.
Mm-hmm.
And that Boston College team had, I think 14 or 15 NHL players on that roster.
Oh,
so
man.
14 or 15 of, you know, 23, 24-man roster ended up playing in the NHL. I mean, that's pretty unheard of.
Right.
And then on our team that year, we had 3 players that played in the NHL. So. Hmm. The way Steph kind of carried our team, well, carried our team is the wrong way, but kind of set the tone for our team, was pretty remarkable.
Sure. Yeah, and it, you know, the way you make it sound is his goals were loud goals when it really mattered.
Yeah, so. That's it. He was just a really timely player. Like, you wouldn't, when we would blow teams out, you wouldn't really notice him in games like that, but when it really got down to it, he you know, the tight 3-2 games, he was the guy that you'd count on.
Sure.
And, you know, there's a reason he's a KHL All-Star right now.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he had all the tools, and he had the heart, and he was competitive. And, you know, he changed the landscape for Merrimack hockey.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, him and, you know, a number of other players.
Right.
He was definitely a leader on that team.
Awesome. All right, man. So outside of the, you know, initially getting to Merrimack and kind of being on that little bit of a bender, are there any other ace stories that you got ready in the holster for us?
I mean, it's college, so there's always going to be some good stories.
Sure.
Looking back to kind of my sophomore year, you know, kind of a good social story that we had was we started off the year really hot. So the year before, we lost in the first game against Notre Dame in the NCAAs. So we were in, I think it was double overtime. I think we ended up scoring on our own net or something. So it was a real, you know, heartbreaker.
Mm.
But that, because we were heavily favored to win that game, probably would have went to the Frozen Four just the way that the bracket lined up.
Mm.
We had a pretty good preseason ranking going into the next season.
Mm-hmm.
And then not to mention we had a hot start. I think we were like 8-0 at Halloween. So
wow.
we ended up going to Vermont the weekend of Halloween, and we ended up, we swept them, I don't know, something like that, but we were still undefeated.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole bus trip home on the Saturday night, we were like, shit, you know, we're the only undefeated team in the country right now. Like, we actually might be ranked number one next week. So we get back, and it's Sunday, and we kind of have ourselves a bit of a day, and there's like somebody's taking pictures and stuff of us, and it all kind of ends up on Facebook. It was nothing like too bad, but it was just mm-hmm. like people with beers in their hands, nothing good. So basically, right. The next day we get a message to come in for a team meeting, and it was pretty much just the, you know, we thought it was because we were going to be number one in the country. Sure enough, we are number one in the country that day. But at the same time, we get the kind of conversation about, hey guys, you got to clean up your social media. This is, you can't be having this stuff. So
ooh, got the old pee-pee whack.
a little bit. And, I mean, it was nothing too bad, but it was kind of like, hey, you know, boys be smart. You guys, it's a small school, and you know, you guys, this is great recognition, but I remember we were all kind of on pins and needles there that day. We were thinking to ourselves, what the hell do we do here?
right. All right, man. Well, you mentioned Mark Dennehy, and he's now with the Devils organization. Talk about, you know, his style and maybe a couple things you liked, you know, when you were playing for him. I don't know if you liked him or not, but, you know, he's doing something right.
No, I definitely liked Mark a lot. He was a great coach. He was a big reason why I chose to go to Merrimack. And, you know, I'm sure if you kind of look at like my points from junior to college, then to Indy, you know, you see that, you know, when I played junior, I was a lot more of a goal scorer, a lot more, you know, it was over a point a game. And then the points kind of dropped off a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, you know, Coach Dennehy had a stern conversation with me in my sophomore year. My freshman year, I played every game except for two. And I just kind of, I was that fourth line center. I won face-ups, did little things, played the minutes I got.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much just don't make any mistakes, be responsible kind of hockey player. And then, you know, you kind of transition the next year. You had seniors leave, you had top players leave. There's a lot more openings, but mm-hmm. there's openings for different types of positions. So I think what Mark did very well was he built out his team for different roles. So mm-hmm. he had his scorers, he had his defensive players, he had his offensive defensemen, his defensive defensemen, his shutdown guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we had a pretty stern conversation my sophomore year for what kind of direction I wanted to take things and where I wanted to be. And for myself, I'd only ever seen myself in kind of a goal scoring light. So it was really tough for me to kind of hear that he needed me to play a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So what I learned from him was just, you know, finding a way to be kind of irreplaceable in the lineup. So there's a certain brand of hockey that not many people are willing to play. And if you play it and you do it well, then there's a spot for you on just about any team. And he kind of taught me that.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't about goals and assists. It was more about doing the little things, being difficult to play against. And I was kind of his go-to guy to play against some of the best players. Well, now they're some of the best players in the world. Like,
right.
my senior year, for example, Johnny Gaudreau had, I think, like 80 points, mm-hmm. but it was my job to line match against him. So whenever Johnny was hopping on the ice, there was a center change, and I would hop over, and I'd be on the ice every second that he was on the ice. And right. I mean, like, that's an opportunity that gets earned through a lot of trust. So sure. It took a long time to get to that point, and, you know, there were other players in the league that I had that same job for, but it's just, you know, it was a different style of hockey that he needed me to play than sure. what I was accustomed to, and he taught me the value in seeing it from a different lens.
Right on. Yeah, I've heard a lot of guys that we've had on say that the college game is so much more structured hockey. Everything is so controlled. That's got to be tiring,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you had three big years in juniors. You had, so you know, 4 years in the middle where you were kind of a role guy. I'm not going to, you know, say you had bad years, but that was definitely the role. You had a different role, and then mm-hmm. you go pro, and then you're lighting it back up. So, I mean, do you like the pro game better?
There are a few different things, like one, playing college hockey, there's no better feeling than putting on your school's jersey, right?
Sure, yeah.
And playing in front of your peers and playing with your roommates and your best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Pro, there's a lot more turnover, so you feel a little less part of something. So, you know, like the 1 year in Indy, we had, you know, maybe 40 guys come through Indianapolis.
Right.
It's hard to really, really get to know people
uh-huh.
when, you know, your contract is kind of day-to-day. And yeah. you could have somebody come in for just a week, so, you know, you don't really get to know that person that well.
Right on.
Whereas college, you know, if your classmates, they're your teammates, they're your classmates, they're everything for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you really get to know these guys. You really go to war for these guys. So, you know, putting on the same jersey with them on Fridays and Saturdays, it doesn't get much better than that. So it's a lot easier to kind of play these different roles. But, you know, the best way to explain it is the higher you go up in hockey, the, you know, the more it gets weeded out, right? So
mm-hmm.
going from juniors to college, everybody that plays college, they lit up juniors. They were the best player on their team in junior hockey.
Right.
And then it just bottlenecks, right? So everybody that goes up to the next level, you have to find your way to contribute to your team. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're kind of useless to your coach, right? So.
Right.
If I would have went to Merrimack and decided, hey, I'm going to be a goal scorer or bust, that's all I'm going to do, I probably would have watched a lot of games and I would have gotten real good at taking stats because I wasn't on the same level as some of our scorers.
Right.
Right. So if I would have, so I had to do something. So
right.
what I started to do is I upped my physical game. I don't know if I laid a body check in junior hockey. I don't know if I blocked a shot in junior hockey. I mean, I did a lot of little things really well. I backchecked hard. I
right.
was good with my stick. But mm-hmm. I didn't do the things that, you know, really get the boys to tap their sticks on the boards.
Yeah.
You know, like I was known at Merrimack as the guy that would just, like, eat pucks. You know, I was probably our best penalty killer for at least, you know, two and a half years that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was because I was really good at getting in front of pucks. And I mean, like, not a lot of people are willing to do that. Not a lot of people are willing to put their hands in front of a, you know, 90-mile-an-hour slap shot.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I was willing to do that, I earned a lot of respect from my teammates and my coaches.
Sure.
And it's kind of something that you kind of thrive into. So
mm-hmm.
once you start getting those stick taps from the guys, like it started to feel like that was like scoring goal for me, like a big block shot on a penalty kill.
It's right.
like I would get the same kind of rush out of that I would, you know, scoring a goal in juniors.
Sure.
So it's kind of a slippery slope,
right?
Where you can get wrapped up in your role, and mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it does take a special person to get excited about those things. Like there's
yeah.
some people that will do everything they can to get out of the way of blocking a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And often those are some of your most talented, best players that you really don't want to block shots anyway.
Right.
But
sure.
But yeah.
Right on. All right, man. So we've talked about the junior side. We talked about the college side. So I kind of want to bring all of that into one question. We've had a lot of people and a lot of discussions on the show about juniors versus college hockey. for you, you kind of had to have one to have the other, but, you know, in the day and age we're in now where it's kind of a decision, where do you lie and what's better for the development and all that?
So I think you said it, like I needed to go to juniors before I could go to college. It's not mm-hmm. like going from high school to college was not an option for me.
Right.
So I was more than happy to go play juniors. I think there's a lot of kids now that have the opportunity to go play for their prep schools or their, you know, traveling midget teams, and then they have the opportunity to step right into college.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're missing a pretty important step, though. I think that there's nothing like, you know, playing junior hockey, getting that small town hockey feel. You know, like when the Ice were in town, I know it's not necessarily a small town. Indianapolis isn't a small town.
Mm-hmm.
But to have that, you know, junior hockey feel where they're, you know, riding the bus for long trips and, you know, getting to know, you know, these young guys. You got some guys who are still in high school who, mm-hmm. you know, who are just, you know, getting their first taste at junior hockey. And,
yeah.
I think you get to be the guy for a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. Like I said, when the higher up you go, the fewer opportunities there are to be, you know, the go-to scorer, the, you know, the guy who runs the power play.
Yeah.
I mean, like my buddies who play college with me and play pro, they can't believe that I used to quarterback power play. And like, it's not because I'm not, you know, capable of doing it. It's just because they see me in such a different light
right.
as somebody who, you know, blocks shots and kills penalties, and the fact that I used to lug the puck up the ice on the power play and everything ran through me, they're like, holy shit, like that's a different red. Like
right.
that's not the guy that we appreciate it.
Right.
So just having that opportunity, like it was to get to be the guy for 3 years in Weyburn and put up the points that I did, and it was a lot of fun. If I didn't get that opportunity, like, you know,
sure.
I probably wouldn't have had the success I did early on in Indy either, because I wouldn't have known what it's like to be the guy.
Right.
I wouldn't have known what it's like to, you know, score. Not that I was the guy in Indy by any means, but, you know, I started to find my scoring touch a little bit more again after college. So, mm-hmm. you know.
Excellent. All right, man, I want to do something we've been doing with our guests. It's called Rapid Fire. All right, I'm going to fire about 5-6 questions. I just want you to fire the first thing that comes to your head, and we'll have a little bit of fun with it.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, man. Favorite music genre?
Country.
Favorite non-hockey city?
Non-hockey city. Oof.
It could be a hockey city, but just somewhere to visit that you're not playing hockey in.
Still London.
Right on. Favorite number?
9.
Go-to N1 karaoke song?
N1. Friends in Low Places.
Very good. Finish the following sentences. When I dance with my old lady, I look like...
an idiot.
Favorite hockey goal?
Favorite hockey goal? Scored a goal in the playoffs in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can go more into that, but...
I mean, hey, you're in one now.
Yeah, no, it was in the playoffs against Maine, and we did this promo where Maine's building is so loud, mm-hmm. and their fans are crazy, so we ended up busing up, like 500 of our students to go to Maine,
mm-hmm.
and we had our own section, they all had these gold shirts on, and I scored a goal in their end, like where all of our fans are sitting.
Yeah.
And I skated behind the net, and I had my hand over my ear, and I looked like a jackass, but just so pumped up in the moment. Didn't score too much in college, like I said, so to get one in the playoffs, I was pretty fired up.
Sure. Oh, man, that's awesome. Oh, man, that's good. Well, I'm glad you did that for us, man. Usually that's a lot of fun, and, you know, people usually get a chuckle out of that, so I appreciate it. So,
yeah.
Friends in Low Places, that's one of mine, too.
Yeah.
That and Chattahoochee.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, man. So, kind of transitioning from the Merrimack to the Indy Fuel. So, kind of give us how you wrapped up your college, degree and career and all that there at Merrimack, and then transitioning into going to camp and all that.
Yeah. So, So senior year didn't go very well for me. We just didn't have a great team. I struggled offensively to put up any sort of numbers, and just all in all, it was kind of a tough year. So I didn't have a lot of opportunities to go on a PTO or anything like that at the end of my senior year. You see a lot, like, you know, at the end of the college season this year, Indy will probably bring in four or five guys, for example. All coast teams are going to bring in guys.
Right.
And I didn't really have that opportunity. So I was pretty bummed out about that. I didn't really know what was going to be next for me. The gears kind of switched, and I was like, you know what? I'm gonna go market myself. I'm gonna reach out to, you know, whatever coach will take my call in the coast, and I'm just gonna try and get myself a tryout. That's what I did. I sent cold emails to all these coaches in the springtime after the season was done, and I was pretty much trying to find somebody to give me a chance to kind of try out and hopefully make a team. Didn't get a lot of responses back because, you know, basically the way you drop those emails is, hey, my name's Rhett. I just finished 4 years of college. You know, here's my stat line. You know, here's two coaches as reference. You know, please let me know if you, you know, have an open spot on your team. You know, whatever, you're training camp next year. So fortunately, you know, Indy being a new team, they have a lot more spots open.
Right.
So Scott Hillman, he gives me a call. I actually didn't even reach out to him because I didn't have any contact info or anything like that. But he gives me a call, so kind of roll reverse there. So
yeah,
obviously he offered me a contract, and it was like, oh, I didn't expect to get a contract.
Before camp,
I was just hoping to try out.
Oh, that's right, because they had that social media thing where. Yeah. They'd sign two or three guys and they'd blow that shit up. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was actually kind of nice. It was, I kind of had a good feeling of where I was going to be. And, I knew that they had signed, you know, they oversigned, and some guys unfortunately get released on their contracts.
Right.
That's just kind of the way the league works is you have to bring in as many guys as you can and kind of build your team from there. And Indy being a, you know, you can look at like Fort Wayne, for example. They've got their nucleus of guys that they bring in every year.
Yeah.
And then they kind of build around that based off of likely a lot of, you know, the recommendations from the guys that do come back year over year. And, you know, Indy has, you know, zero returning players, so they don't really have that. So they brought in, ton of players all under contract. And fortunately, I played well enough to make the team, but yeah, that's kind of how I ended up in Indy.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, did they call you before they had you sign? I mean, did you know any of the other guys that had signed? I mean, you mentioned a nucleus. Sometimes that requires some cohesion with the guys that have, you know, committed to the team. Was there any of that?
So they called me, and pretty much Hilly said, hey, we had somebody watch you at the end of last year. Like, I was coaching in Missouri. Unfortunately, you know, we were in playoffs and we had our guys, so we didn't bring you out. But I'm now in Indianapolis. You know, could you see yourself living in Indianapolis? He's like, okay, like, take the time, like, research the city, you know, do all of this. You know, here's where we're going to be living. Here's where we play. Mm-hmm. You know, let me know what you think. We'll talk in a week. And then I hang up the phone. I'm like, could be Siberia, Russia. Like, this is an opportunity for me to play pro hockey. I didn't think I was going to get this opportunity. So, no matter what, I'm going to sign this contract. So, a week later, he, you know, presents the contract to me, and I say, yeah, I'll sign. Like, I didn't care how much it was for. I just, the opportunity to play was there, and I was psyched for it. So, there really wasn't a nucleus of guys there. I didn't know a single person going there. I knew a lot of the guys just from playing against them.
Right.
And then the hockey world's small, so you have friends of friends who you find out who are going there. Actually, it's kind of funny. So after, you know, probably, like you said, they were doing the announcements and stuff. And I was living in Boston and training in Boston just after I graduated. So I hadn't been home very much. But one of the guys that I grew up kind of playing with. I think the first time we played together, we were like 12 and 13 years old, was Garrett Klotz.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you remember Garrett Klotz.
I do.
He's been in the East Coast League for a while. He's played in the American League, and he was a draft pick of the Philadelphia Flyers. Find out he's going there, and I've actually known him for a long time. So he was really the only familiar face in that locker room when I got there. So it was good to see him and to see him do well. And he was instantly a fan favorite. So
man, he could get him off.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. God. He was always like that.
Really?
He was always like that. Oh. He was a bruiser, that guy.
Yeah. Between him and there's another dude, I can't remember his name. Oh, they'd get him off twice a night and be done.
Johnny McGuire.
I don't know if that was him or not. I can't. You could say any name, and I'd be like, maybe. But yeah, Garrett was one of those guys that, man, it'd be a yard sale right off the puck drop.
Oh, yeah.
It was unreal. Yeah. So
he was a showman, that's for sure.
Yeah, he was something else. So
yeah.
Right on.
He's been doing that a long time, so he knows his way around the penalty box, that's for sure.
Sure. Yeah, he's played in a ton of markets, too. I would, you know, it would be a tough decision for him to say, what's your favorite market you've played in? But,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, you spent 2 years here in Indianapolis, and you know, I've been a season ticket holder since day one, so, you know, what was it that stuck out about Indianapolis that you really liked?
I mean, it's a great city to be in. Like, you know, it's the Midwest kind of feels very much like home to me.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a lot like Saskatchewan, where, you know, the people are so friendly, the city's, you know, very nice. Like, the downtown area is small, but it's very beautiful, very clean. And it's a great sports town, right? Like you got the Colts, the Pacers, you know, now you got the Fuel there. I know there's a lot of fans who really miss the ice. It'd be great for them to come back. But it was just a great place to be. The Hallets run such a great organization there. The players get treated so well. You know, I obviously only played in one East Coast League market and, any player that we ever got on a trade, they'd show up at our apartments, they'd show up to the rink, they'd travel with us, and they'd be like, holy shit, like, you guys get treated like gold. And, like, I think that just speaks volumes to the ownership and, you know, how great of a job that they do. So the Howell family's done a great job of building that program, and, I think it's definitely up there for best places to play in the East Coast League, for sure.
Right.
As far as what I've heard. I should say.
Right on. Well, what was maybe one thing you didn't like about Indianapolis?
One thing I didn't like? Oh, man. Well, I wish we would have made the playoffs.
Yeah.
That kind of stings. But we had a lot of fun. We had, I remember my first year, you know, we started off well, and then we went on such a cold streak for about a month and a half, where I don't know if we won a game. And I think we were in dead last in the entire league. And the Hallett family came down and they spoke to us and they pretty much said, hey guys, you guys gotta get your shit together. I mean, we're trying to build out a fan base here, and it's hard when the product on the ice isn't even close to winning games. So we had such a great group of guys. We kind of banded together and just rallied around the fact that it was like, all right, we're in dead last, expectations are really low for us. People aren't expecting much from us. Let's just have some fun with it. And I don't know if have you seen Semi Pro?
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Flint, Michigan Mega Bowl or whatever.
Yeah, I grew up in Flint.
So we started making a joke that like we will win fourth place in our division. So like after like we went on like a crazy winning streak where I think we had like 12 or 13, I don't know, something like that, where we just kept on winning.
Right.
And it was like months of just wins and wins. We went from dead last in the league to actually competing for a playoff spot. But after every win, we'd all skate out and we'd get around Matt Caruth or Shane Owen, whoever was starting. We'd be jumping up and down, yelling, fourth place on the ice. It was unbelievable.
Holy shit. What happened to that guy?
to which one?
Caruth, holy fuck.
Mac, he's actually doing incredibly well. He's playing in the Austrian league.
That's right. I'm pulling up his DB right now. He fell off the face of the earth. You said that name, I'm like, holy fuck, I haven't heard his name in forever.
Yeah. He's playing the team's in Hungary, but it's in the Austria league.
Holy,
he's doing really well.
Yeah, he's got a 2.56 and 9.30. Holy fuck, in 40 games.
Yeah,
that's unreal. Right on, man. Yeah.
No shocker there. He was such a great goaltender.
He really was.
We just, and I know fans like ripped on him in Indy.
Oh my gosh, I always thought he was
so good.
Yeah. When he would get,
so good.
Yeah, he got called up a couple times, and I'm like, I pray to God he never comes back. I would, because I felt bad for him, because you know what I mean.
people just, I don't think that they really understood that, you know, our team was so bad in front of him, mm-hmm. that even on games where he would let up 4 or 5 goals, maybe even more sometimes, he was still playing well. He was still playing well because he was getting, these weren't just like 35 shot games, these are 2-on-1s, 3-on-1s, like we really weren't playing well.
So you guys were kind of teeing up stuff for him
in the brunt of that losing streak, and then obviously when we turn things around it's a lot more fun. And
yeah, for sure. Right on, man. I had what's your fondest memory in Indy? While I look something up.
I gotta say that win streak, because in the inaugural season there, we had such a great group of guys. Like, we all kind of came together. I mean, in all reality, we were a bunch of guys right out of college, right out of major, junior, whatever. None of us knew how to be pros.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we traded for Garrett Bembridge, and
who was sick.
He's just a seasoned veteran who knows how to get the job done. And he really took a lot of us under his wing. And then we brought in guys like Evan Vossen midway through the year, another, you know, great veteran player of 5 years or so, who just knew how to travel, knew how to, you know, have fun outside of the rink, and then, you know, come to work and practice hard and really just kind of demanded more out of all of us. And
right.
You know, a couple key trades that we brought in, you know, bringing in Kyle Stroh midway through the year.
What was he like? He came in hot.
Mm-hmm. So Strozzi, I actually know him from growing up. We we played on the same summer league team together for years. And he sent me a text when he got traded, and I hadn't heard from him in probably like 5 years. And he said, "Hey man, like, I'm driving from Rapid City. I just got traded to Indy." And I was like, "Oh, like, it's great. Like, good to hear from you, man." So, anyways, he ends up making the drive down. This is actually a funny story. And it was like a snowstorm when he was driving. So he made it all the way from Rapid City, South Dakota, to Indianapolis. And he gives me a call when he's close to the apartments. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, "Hey, I'm just going to pull over and grab some Qdoba, get something to eat." Sure enough, he gets in this crazy accident.
What?
Pedals off. He makes it like this whole trip in a snowstorm, and then he totals off his car 5 minutes from the end of his destination.
That will break your heart.
But no, Strozzi was a great guy. He was a great teammate, and he's another one of those like great trades that Hilly pulled off that year.
Sure.
Just to bring in good people who ultimately helped the team turn things around.
Man. But, him, Chris, and Vinny were the only plus players on the roster that year.
Yeah.
They were.
Because they didn't have to sit through that couple months where we were getting blown out.
That was brutal, yeah. Well, and you feel for guys like a Matthew Brisebois, like a Kirill Godovets, guys who were pretty solid, but they just either they weren't on the same pair together. Those guys are both D-men, but you know, they either didn't play together a whole lot or they just couldn't get the flow right. I mean, shit, they were both minus, you know, 20 plus, but they weren't necessarily horrible. I don't think either one of those guys were horrible. But
no, not at all. They were both really good players.
Shit, Matthew was on Rockford money, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think Godovitz was too.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that was another guy where I was like, man, I hope he gets called up and never comes back. I, you know, he played such a sick game, and I'm trying to think of another guy that was there. Man, I can't think of his name. He's a D-man. He might have been after your time. Robin Press, another guy who you feel bad for. He's not an ECHL level guy.
Yeah, I think he was after me.
Yeah. So right on. All right. So we kind of discussed Indy at length here. So talk to us about your exodus in Indy, and then kind of your career in France, because that's something that wasn't super well documented here, and not a lot of people know.
Yeah. So after that second year in Indianapolis, I had a pretty good year. It was kind of frustrating as a team. We had the coaching change from Hilly to Bernie, and when I had my exit meeting with Bernie, it was kind of just like, hey, where do you see me fitting in? And Bernie was like, hey, we'd love to have you come back next year. Obviously you'd be getting a pretty significant pay bump for what you did for us this year. And I kind of laid it out there as like, hey, I'd like a shot at the American Hockey League. I don't know if I had really earned a shot at the American Hockey League. I mean, throughout the course of the 2 years, there were times where, an agent gives you a call and says, hey, expect a call from, this team. They're going to be, they're low on forwards. They're going to be bringing you up. Mm-hmm. And it never happens. So, you have that ups and downs over the course of, a season or two. Mm-hmm. And I had never had a taste of it. I'd never been to a training camp, but never, nothing like that. So I just kind of said to Bruni, is there any shot of this happening? And he just, he kind of said, I don't know if it's going to happen for you in Rockford. I think you're in a good spot here. The Hallets love you. We love you as a coaching staff.
The fucking fans love you.
Yeah, we think the fans love you, so.
Your jersey sales are down, but we think it's positive. I don't know.
So it was a really positive meeting in the sense that I had a pretty secure spot in Indianapolis. But at the same time, I was, 2 years in, I was looking for, maybe to take that next step, and it didn't really seem like that was going to happen in that organization. So I kind of entertained the idea. At some point, I always did want to go to Europe and go play. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what the right time was and when to go do it. So I just spent the next few weeks and I spoke with a few European agents and they all kind of put in their two cents as to where they think that I should go play. And ultimately it was what country do I want to go to at that point? Where is the hockey any good there? Do you get treated well? Are you guaranteed to get paid? Because there are a lot of countries that, that doesn't necessarily happen. There's no players union or anything. So, if something goes wrong, if you get hurt, if anything like that happens and they pull the plug in your contract, what does that look like? So, I was really careful. I was talking to a few of my friends who had played overseas, in different countries. And again, a lot of this was, reaching out very similar to the way I did with, when I first got to Indy, trying to get a spot somewhere in the East Coast League. It was, you when you're talking to these coaches, all they're doing is really pulling up your hockey DB, and then you're providing a couple references for them. And fortunately, I had good relationships with a lot of my coaches over the years, so I had really good references to use. Right. And then usually it was not a lot of interest when they look at hockey DB. Then they talk to a coach, and then now they're pretty interested, which is really nice. I think I had a lot of coaches really pump my tires. So I did. I had, probably five or six good offers that I was entertaining, and the money was all really good compared to what I was making before. So, I ended up settling on France, as being, very, very nice country. The team that I was going to was, had a handful of ex-NHL players. We had, they kept on raving about this 16-year-old player that they had, this French phenom. And turns out after that season, he ends up going in the second round of the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Who was it?
So his name was Alex Texier.
Alex Pekosic.
He now plays in Finland. So he actually just signed, I think he signed his entry level maybe last year, but he ended up getting loaned to Finland.
Huh.
But he was an absolute stud. Like this kid can flat out play. He was such a good pick by them. But you know, at every single game that we had in France, there were NHL scouts there.
Right.
And it was, and you know, I'm not looking at, you know, a career transition to go play in France as a shot to, you know, climb the ranks back in North America. It was, mm-hmm. I'm going to France because, one, it was this cool little town that was nestled in the mountains. So it was,
Grenoble?
Grenoble. So it was this beautiful little city. I'd never been to Europe before. So I was really excited to go there. The team, you know, was one of the historically best teams in the league. So the one thing about European hockey is there's not a lot of parity, right? So most countries, they have two or three teams that have a shit ton of money, uh-huh. and then they pretty much just buy championships.
Interesting.
So for me, it was important to get on one of those teams. I could probably have gone to a different country, maybe a country that, it has a little bit more of a hockey reputation, but instead I wanted to go to a top team where you're going to be treated well, where with a shot at winning the championship. So,
sure.
So sure enough, got a contract from Grenoble. Was really excited about it, and I ended up going there. It was short lived for me. So,
I noticed that you didn't play any regular season, but you had a 12-game playoff. What happened? Well, there's the story.
Yeah, so training camp there is like 5-6 weeks long.
Mm-hmm.
So I get there first week of August, and training camp is actually training camp. Like these French players, mm-hmm. they're talented, but they don't like train like the way you would see North Americans train for hockey, mm-hmm. is very different than the way these French players would train for hockey.
Mm-hmm.
So our team had, I think we had 11 imports on our team.
Mm-hmm.
Some Canadians, some, you know, Czech, Finnish, Slovenian. So we had three players from the Slovenian national team. We had,
Golichik.
Yeah, Golichik.
Unreal, right?
He was unreal, yeah. I think he's still there. Rodman and then Kirill. They were all absolute studs.
Right on.
Yeah, like they play with Kopitar in the Olympics.
What a treat.
Yeah. So, and then we had a handful of the French national players. We had, we had a really stacked team.
Right on.
But training camp is pretty much, they call it the running the Bastille.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a mile up a mountain, and it takes you forever because it's just straight uphill. So like these gazelle Frenchmen just running up this hill, and like us Canadians are like just bringing in the rear. cannot get up this mountain.
Oh,
but yeah, so training camp was, you know, essentially 2 days with two workouts a day as well. So it's kind of like boot camp, get you back in shape. Fortunately, I was in pretty good shape going in there, so it wasn't too bad. It was just kind of nice getting acclimated, and mm-hmm. you know, you got to kind of earn your stripes to the new team. So
right.
So we're about 2 weeks into training camp, and then we have kind of our first exhibition games. So we go, we're playing a team from the league below, and then a league, or and then another team from our league.
Mm-hmm.
First game goes really well. They got a couple points, and you know, we pumped this team from the league below, like, I don't know, it was like 9-1 or something. Like, it was ridiculous. But it was just my first taste of European hockey, and it's like, I'm not a big guy or anything like that, but I was able to be like a bit of a bully out there. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons why the team brought me in, was because my coaches all talked about my physical presence, hardworking, mm-hmm. good in the corners, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And just out there, you start playing with these Euros, and it's just everything's
soft,
you know, exponentially I'm exponentially stronger than a lot of these guys. And that's not like I'll say right now, I'm not a big guy, but I was able to kind of run guys over a lot easier and have a little bit more of an impact on the game from that side. So I was having a lot of fun doing that. But then the next game, it was like the last few minutes in the first period, and I'm carrying the puck up the ice, and it's like a 1-on-3, and I go to take like a bit of a toe drag into a shot, and the puck kind of bumps over my stick a little bit. It was, you know, August ice, so wasn't really sitting flat for me, and I kind of get blindsided by a back checker, and he kind of hits me on like the back of my shoulder, and just my body kind of buckles over my right knee, and I remember like kind of my knee kind of like spun out underneath me, and thinking like I get up and I go and I finish a check, and then I go in front of the net, and I'm like, shit, like this kind of hurts, like it feels almost like a Charlie horse. So I was just kind of sitting there. I'm like, it's late in the period. Like, I don't really want to have to back check. So I just kind of make a line change. So I skate off the ice. But as soon as, like my glide and my skate was fine. But as soon as I step on kind of the rubber matting, it feels like there's nothing holding my knee together. So as soon as I take a step, I just, like, hit the ground. Like,
oh, my.
The coach and the trainer come running over. They're like, are you okay? Like, what's going on? And I'm just like, no, I'm fine. Like, nothing hurts. So I get up and I'm trying to walk it off. And every step I take, it's just like, I feel like Bambi. So I'm sitting there thinking, my heart's racing a little bit. I'm like, all right, something's seriously wrong here. So in between periods, you have to skate off the ice to get to the locker room. So as soon as I step on the ice, I can skate fine. I can do like crossovers and stuff. I'm testing and I'm like, this is weird. This is the weirdest
thing. That is super weird.
So then I go into the locker room, and again, same thing. I have to get somebody to come to pretty much carry me to the trainer's table. And our trainer doesn't speak like a lick of English. So I'm on the table. He kind of points and he's got me like taking equipment off, and you know, I have to show him my knee. And he starts running a few tests, and I've got, you know, the GM is now there, and he's looking over me. Coach comes up to me, and he's like, hey, are you okay? And I'm just like, yeah, I'm fine. Like, I'll be back next period. It's not a big deal. And he's like, no, it's a friendly game. Like, just take the rest of the night off. So I'm like, all right, whatever, fine. So the trainer pretty much, it gets loosely translated to me that, it's, you know, you could be out 2 weeks or 10 months. And I'm just like, oh, all
right, that's a big gap.
That's a pretty big gap. Like, there's got to be something in the middle there. Like, I'm thinking to myself, there's no way this is 2 weeks. So I'm looking at 10 months, like, no way. So in my shoe, like, everything feels fine, right? Because, you know, your foot is flat, so you can kind of keep the balance there. Everything feels fine. We have an MRI set up for, you know, a couple days. I think it was like, this was on a Sunday. We have the MRI maybe the next day on Monday. So we show up to the rink on Monday, and I get all changed out for we have another workout because it's training camp, and you have two workouts a day. So I'm in my gear, and I'm just like, hey, this is fine. Like, I'm doing like piston squats, so like one-legged squats, and and like, I'm like, if my knee was, there's something wrong with it, like I wouldn't be able to do this. And they were just like, okay, let's just go take a picture. Like, you have the day off. So I go, and sure enough, I go to get to the MRI, and just calmly, they show me my knee, and they're like, oh, look, right there. That's where it's snapped. You've got two ACLs, not one. So I'm just like, oh, so I have a torn ACL. Is that what you're saying? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, okay, so how long am I out for? And he's like, oh, next season. And like, it's just such broken English that like, there's no conversation. Like, I can't get any explanation for what is actually wrong. He just points and says like two and not one. And like, I can see it very clearly. Like, there's nothing holding my knee together.
Right.
And, so I'm like, whatever. We get in the car, and I'm like, all right, this really sucks. Like, was doing well here for a couple weeks, and 2 weeks in, I blow out my knee. So we're on our ride back, and the GM's driving me, and he's clearly on the phone with the coach, and they're speaking French, so I don't understand words that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I come back, and basically I sit down at the coach's desk, and the GM and the coach are on the other side, and they're like, hey, like, we're really sorry this happened to you. What do you want to do here? And I was just like, well, you know, can we get like a second opinion? What's kind of the protocol for this? And then, basically the coach says to me, we think that you're kind of the missing piece. Like this team really doesn't have a lot of turnover. I think I was one of three new players to the team, three or four new players to the team that year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he kind of figured, you know, you're a unique player for this league. Nobody really plays with your physicality and
mm-hmm.
speed and whatever. We think that you could be kind of the missing piece for our playoff run here.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be willing to play through this injury this year? And I'm thinking to myself, like, well, I mean, why not, right? Like, I've played through injuries before. I've played through, you know, broken hands, sprained mm-hmm. shoulders. I've done it before. Like, well, like, how could this be any different, really? And, he, you know, just the way he asked me, he was really, you know, polite about it. He wasn't like, hey, we need you to play. It was just like, hey, would you be willing to do this? So I was mm-hmm. like, yeah, why not? Let me go do some reading and see what goes into this. So I go and I call my trainer, the guy that I work with in the summers, and I just say, like, hey, like, you know my body as good as anyone. Like, is there any chance I could play through this year? And he starts laughing. He's like, Rhett, you're going to need a brand new knee if you try and play through a torn ACL for, you know, 8 months.
Right.
So right there, I'm like, yeah, you know, that's probably right. So I go back to the team the next day, and I just say, hey, like, I think we got to do this the right way, and I need to, you know, have the surgery taken care of, and, you know, we'll be back, you know, next season, whatever. And they're like, no, what do you mean? Like, you'll be back next season. Like, they already had made it very clear that they wanted me to come play next season. So I was like, yeah, like, we'll just do this next year. Like, well, I'll take care of my knee. I'll be back and I'll be ready to go for next season.
Right.
And, they were just like, no, like, that's not how this is going to work. Like, we need you to play.
How did they expect you to play? I guess I'm confused.
It was more like a in the moment thing where it was like, I was taken back and they're pretty much just like, get out of here. Like, like, we need to talk now because we don't know what we want to do.
Mm.
And then I kind of started thinking to myself, like, holy shit, like, I've heard some horror stories of players going to Europe and not getting paid once they get hurt.
Mm.
And I was like, is that going to happen? So I start, you know, like, the team has given me no indication that they're going to stop paying me. Let's put it that way.
Right.
But I'm sitting there in my head playing every negative scenario that could happen. Like, my knee's toast. They're going to send me home. And then just, boom, stop paying me. And I'm not going to, mm-hmm. you know, so I can just go play hockey for another team because I don't have a knee. So,
right.
So I'm kind of freaking out. And then I start thinking about it. I'm like, well, you know, the more I research, it's a minimum 6 month recovery time. I have no swelling in my knee, so I can go get the surgery taken care of, you know, right away.
Mm-hmm.
So sure, I'm gonna go get this done.
So you're still in camp. So at this point, you're still in camp, correct?
Yeah, we're still in camp. This is middle of August right now.
Oh shit! So you got tons of time.
Yeah, exactly.
You could probably play half the regular season.
So I'm thinking if you really look at the months, so the first round of playoffs started end of February.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at the months, and if I got my surgery done right away, we've got September, October, November, December, January, end of February, that's 6 months right there.
Mm-hmm.
That's best case scenario is me playing for the first round. So I go to the team and I say, hey, listen, I have no swelling in my knee. I can get the surgery done tomorrow if we want. What do you think about that? And then me playing in the playoffs. So they're like, okay, like, you know, we're going to replace you right now, but we're going to keep you on our roster
right.
so that we have that opportunity. So right away, we kind of scrambled to get the team doctor on board and to have the surgery. And he's really skeptical about it. He's saying, no. Like, I'm not going to clear you to play because the way it kind of works for him is because he only works with athletes like pro skiers, you know, the mm-hmm. hockey players, rugby players. So he has like his own like record. And this is kind of how he sells himself as a surgeon.
Sure.
Is like, I have 100% success rate with ACL in repairs.
Mm-hmm.
And if I come back too early and I tear my ACL, then he's like, now I have 98% or, you know, 99%.
Whatever. Right.
Like, he doesn't want that on his record. So he's like, I'm not going to clear you no matter what.
Right.
And, you know, the owner of the team, he's got a lot of money to throw around, and he's just kind of like, we'll take care of him. Like, don't worry. Like, we'll play. If you can pass your test, you're going to play.
Right.
So I'm like, great. So now I have a goal to shoot for.
Yeah.
So the surgery was really funny. The surgery was really funny because, when I meet the surgeon again, he doesn't speak a lick of English. So it's all kind of loosely translated through the GM, who is Canadian, but he's French Canadian, and his English isn't great either. So a lot of it's kind of getting lost in translation
mm-hmm.
when it, by the time he gets to me. So basically he says you have two options. You know, it's a pretty standard ACL repair. Two options. One, we knock you out for the surgery, and then, but then because of the way the anesthesia works, you know, after, you know, you have rehab starting the day after the surgery,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're going to feel a lot of pain because there's not a lot that we can do for you because, you know, it takes a lot to knock you out.
Mm-hmm.
Option two, we keep you awake for the surgery, and we just kind of pretty much paralyze you from the belly button down. And then after the surgery, we pump your knee full of, painkillers, anesthesia, whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
And you won't feel a thing likely for the next couple of days. So when you start your rehab and you start, you know, moving your knee around, it's not going to be as painful. So I'm like, great. What do most people do? And what I think he says is most people stay awake, but what he really says is most people go to sleep for the surgery. So I'm like, all right, like I'll stay awake then. Like that's what most people do. That's what I'm going to do too. And like the logic was airtight. Like I'm not going to feel anything in my knee for the next few days. Like that's right. What I want. Well, that's not what most people do. Most people just get knocked out for the surgery. So, they kind of walk me through everything. They say, you know, you're going to wear headphones for the surgery so
yeah.
you can't hear anything. So make
sure.
a playlist. the surgery lasts between, you know, an hour and 20 to an hour and 40 minutes. So I'm thinking in my head, okay, 2 hours of music, done, I can do that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you'll be, surgery's at 9, you'll be out of there by noon. It's really quick, right. It's routine.
Yeah.
So I'm like, great, that's no problem. Like, that's, I've got all my painkillers and stuff like that
sure.
for the week.
You've got the Carter 3 and the Carter 4 queued up, you're good.
Yeah, I'm good to go. So I, ultimately, the day of the surgery, I show up, I come to the hospital. The nurse that they assigned to me speaks fluent English, which is great.
Ideal.
So she's explaining to me what's going to happen. She's going to stick the needle in my spine, so I'm not going to be able to feel anything from the legs down. Sure enough, within seconds, like, I'm paralyzed. I'm sending nerves through to my toes, trying to wiggle my toes. Nothing's happening. Nothing's moving. So I'm like, all right, I guess we're ready for the surgery. So she wheels me into the room. They strap you down. So what I didn't know is that they actually tie your arms basically to a cross.
Mm.
So like if like you have a panic attack, you can't freak out and like
right.
start hitting people and stuff like that.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So I'm literally strapped down to this table and I have my headphones on, music's playing, and the surgery's kind of underway. And the whole time I'm just so tensed up because I know what's going on down there, but
mm-hmm.
I can't feel it. It's just, it feels like a vibrating, like, kind of numbness.
Mm.
And, like, between songs, you can hear, like, drilling and stuff like that.
Oh.
When, you know, like, the second or two in between songs.
Mm.
So I can hear, like, what's going on and, like, them muttering to each other in French. And I'm just like, geez, this is a nightmare. I regret doing this. So, the time kind of goes by pretty quickly, actually, and the music kind of stops playing, and I'm like, it's 2 hours of music. They said it would be like an hour and 40 minutes max. Like, I put in the 20-minute buffer for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I could hear everything, and I'm sitting there, and I'm starting to feel a little uncomfortable, and I'm like kind of moving side to side a little bit, and I'm moving my hips and stuff, and the nurse that speaks English comes over, and she takes my headphones off. And she says, hey, can you feel anything? And then it just, like, hits me like that. Like, I can feel everything that they're doing in my knee right now. And
oh.
it's just, like, within seconds, it's just, like, the most painful thing I can imagine.
Oh, my God. You're still like, open?
I'm still open.
Oh.
The surgery is not done yet. And and I just, like, tense up and I freak out. And I'm just, like, what the, like, I'm freaking out.
Yeah.
And within seconds, I'm knocked out cold. So
they hit you with a needle.
They hit, yeah, they did. They, well, it's like a gas mask. They pretty much put on my face. And then I was out.
Man.
So then I wake up, and I'm in this big room with a bunch of different tables, and I'm on, like, the bed, and I look up, and I see a clock, and it's 6 o'clock p.m. So I was supposed to be out of there 6 hours ago. And I'm just laying there, and I have this big, like, ice machine wrapped around my leg, and it's, like, this compression thing. So mm-hmm. it's supposed to keep the blood flow going and, you know, obviously keep the swelling down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoarse from the surgery because I've had, you know, I just kind of came to from being knocked out cold.
Right.
And I'm just, like, kind of screaming, like, nurse, nurse, trying to get somebody to, like, come and talk to me and tell me what happened. Because I can see the time. I'm like, geez, something went seriously wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the nurses that doesn't speak English, she wheels me into this separate room by myself. And then the nurse and the doctor come in and they speak to me and I'm like, hey, like what happened here? And he's just like, before you panic, like I want you to know surgery went perfect. Like I did great work here. And I was like, okay, you're not making me feel any better because I
don't mean to pump my own tires here, but
yeah, this something went wrong. Like, I don't know what you're trying to tell me. So it turns out that I don't know how they made this mistake, but what happened was I had a torn ACL, a torn MCL, and my meniscus was just shredded. So it wasn't just an ACL surgery. So I don't know if they didn't take enough pictures on the MRI.
Mm.
But when they opened up my knee, they pretty much saw, like, oh, we've got a whole mess of work.
It was just destroyed.
And I guess he made the executive decision to do everything at once because, you know, I mean, we had this conversation before that, you know, my goal was to play in the playoffs. And in order to do that, I needed to have a really clean surgery off the start so I could start my rehab right away.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what would have happened is they gave me the anesthesia for the ACL surgery. They didn't give me the anesthesia for all three surgeries.
Yeah.
And what would have had to happen is if they just did the ACL, I would have had to wait for the swelling to go down, which would have been another 6 weeks to 2 months before right. I could have the MCL surgery.
Then
it would have prolonged my recovery. So basically they crammed it all into one, and he thought that he was able to do it with enough time. And ultimately he ran out of time and I felt everything. So, it was a pretty cool surgery story. But yeah, the knee ended up, you know, he did actually do great work.
Yeah.
The knee, when I did my tests at, this is a funny story too. So I do my rehab for, you know, the first check-in with your doctor is at 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he was just like, well, no, that's not true. So you have a couple check-ins along the way.
Right.
And the whole time he's like, hey, Brett, like, this is a full knee that we did here. You're not playing this year. You're not playing this year. And I'm just like, all right, like, we'll see. Like, we have a plan in place. Let's, you know, that's still 5 months out. Let's, let's take the steps we need to.
Mm-hmm.
So every time we meet, he's like, no, you're not playing. You're not playing. But then the 3 month one is kind of like the turning point for you. If all the swelling's down, if you have, you know, a certain range of mobility, then you can really progress your weight training. Mm-hmm. And basically the plan we had set up was I was to train for 4 months after my surgery. And then they would send me home for Christmas. So my wife and I would go back to Boston and I would do, you know, some more training there for Christmas.
Whoa, hang on, pause. When did you get married?
Oh, I got married in 2017.
So she was there. Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine how she felt.
Yeah, so she was there with me the whole time. So it was, I had somebody kind of with me to make it a little less lonely.
Sure.
I'll dive a little bit more into just like the living in Europe experience in general. But
yeah.
So the two of us, we went back kind of middle of December to kind of spend time with her family. And then we went back to Saskatchewan, spent time with my family at Christmas. And then we came back to Boston, which is where I was supposed to go back kind of alone that time.
Mm-hmm.
And because my wife was going back to school, she was getting her master's in social work. So she was resuming her school at that time, and I was just going to go finish up the year kind of by myself in Grenoble and just go live with one of the guys.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, the team was, like, kind of written me off at that point, and they're like, the team was clicking, they're on a massive win streak, and they were like, hey, you got your contract for next year, like, I think where we're at now is we're just gonna leave you in Boston, and then you'll come back next year. And I was just like, hey, we had a plan, like, let's stick to the plan here, like, I can help the team in playoffs. So I at this 3 month meeting that I have, the doctor kind of, it was the first time he had said, like, hey, I think you might actually have a shot at playing this year. Mm-hmm. So now it's really on me and how I can strength train to get back to where I was before the injury. And so basically I started doing 2-a-days and, you know, 2-a-days, 10 days, or 10 workouts a week.
Mm-hmm.
I was running on treadmills, I was biking, I was doing, you know, some light squats, mobility work, a lot of band stuff, really just anything that I read about that would help this kind of injury, I kind of tried. So I kind of built my own curriculum for how to repair an ACL, and mm-hmm. ultimately what happened is I started skating before I was supposed to, with no knee brace, nothing. I had a friend who was coaching prep school team,
mm-hmm.
and I just started practicing with them, and I just, like, told all the kids, like, hey guys, like, be careful around me, like, try not to bump into me, like, I know it's not your fault, like, I'm, you know, on your time, but, like, if I step on a puck, or if I, you know, kind of fall into the boards awkwardly, like, it could be a pretty serious injury. And I don't even know if I would be insured at that point, because I didn't have, like, a doctor's permission to do anything, so it was really kind of a sketchy time for me, but I was skating, you know, 5 times a week, I was training, like, 10 workouts in a week, and, finally, like, the team was kind of dodging me a little bit, and I was just like, hey, guys, like, I can help the team, guys, like, on the team were messaging me, like, how are you doing, like, what's going on,
mm-hmm.
I was just like, hey, I'm ready to come back. And they're like, yeah, we actually need you. Like, we just had an injury this past weekend. Like, we're going to need you. And so my buddy who was coaching the team, the team as in, like, the prep school team, mm-hmm. he had a pretty big Instagram following, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He emailed, Instagrammed, and put on Facebook these videos of me skating. And it was just, like, simple, like, footwork drills.
Yeah.
You couldn't tell that I was hurt.
Right.
And I don't know how it happened, but it ended up working its way where, like, the team, the Grenoble team, ended up retweeting and, like, posting all this stuff about, like, my return, my recovery. And then...
Those guys, they totally use that for their business. That's dirty. Anyway.
Sure enough, like, clockwork, I get a call from the GM saying, hey, we just had an injury. I know you had an injury. Like, I've been talking to guys the whole time.
Oh.
And he's just like, we have a flight for you. So at this point, I'm at 5.5 months. I'm early on my recovery. They say that you cannot do any physical contact until 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at, like, you know, 5 months and 14 days. And he's mm-hmm. like, hey, you know, it's a Wednesday. He's like, can you fly out tomorrow night? And I'm like, yeah, I can fly out tomorrow night.
It better be first class, though.
Yeah, I was just so happy that I was going to get the chance to play, or at least I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he's like, we can't guarantee that you're going to play. We have to get the doctor to approve. What's going to happen is you're going to fly out on, you know, Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
So you get in, like, Friday afternoon. You're going to skate with the team on Saturday. And then on Sunday, we're going to go, or you're going to skate with, the team, or sorry, Saturday was a day off. You're going to skate with the team on Sunday, and then Monday you have a doctor's appointment at, you know, 5 o'clock, and the game's at 8 o'clock. And he's like, well, no, you'll pretty much know if you're going to play after that. So, like, great. That sounds like a great plan. So I show up on the flight. I fly into Lyon, France. We drive down to Grenoble, mm-hmm. and he's like, how you feeling? We're talking about different things. He's like, here's where we see you fitting in. All this stuff, like, we're pretty much game planning like I am gonna play.
Mm-hmm.
I show up, and, like, I will say, like, one thing that I did, like, I wanted to do when I was injured was every time they had practice or every time they had morning skate or something, I would come to the rink and I'd hang out with the guys while they're getting ready, and then when they go on the ice, I'd do, like, bike sprints or, like, a light workout or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, just so I was, like, getting to know the guys, so it wouldn't be like I was this brand-new player showing up for the first time at the end of the year. So So the guys were all so happy to see me, like, you know, it was just like a real warm welcoming. Mm-hmm. I practiced, I was on the line in practice, which I didn't expect. I kind of expected just to have, like, you know, my own stuff that I was doing on the side of the ice, but I was doing line rushes and stuff like that. I felt good. I fit in. Even the coach was just like, hey, like, you look great. You look great. Like, we're going to play you. Like, if you get cleared, we're going to play you. So I had this doctor's appointment. The day of the game, instead of going to morning skate, I had to run a bunch of strength tests. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much like a full workout. And sure enough, my injured knee ended up testing stronger than my non-injured knee. So they were like, yeah, by our calculations, you're good to go. And then I ended up meeting with this doctor, you know, 3 hours before the game. And he was like pretty skeptical about it, but he's like, there's nothing I can say that stops you from playing tonight. So good luck. So I'm like, I can play. And so we like rushed to the rink. Everybody's already like half dressed, and I'm showing up 20 minutes before warm-ups.
No pregame nap, brutal.
No pregame nap, nothing. I'm gassed because I just did a workout where I was doing like these extensions and flexions and stuff on this like apparatus all day. So
right.
I have no legs or anything like that, but I know I was excited to play. They did like a pregame ceremony for me. Like our team come out of this like, we were called the Brule de Loup, which is loosely translated to wolf burners.
Mm-hmm.
So we come out to this big like wolf mouth with like a smoke show. And so I come cruising out there by myself. They do like a big ceremony before the game. It was really cool. So
that's awesome, man.
So I got to play my first game in Europe. So yeah. it was a playoff game, packed barn. We had great crowds. So it was a lot of fun.
So
it was a lot of hard work went into it.
Sure. And I bet you playing that game, that sense of accomplishment had to be dang near better than anything in your hockey career, I imagine.
Yeah, it was, because, like, you know, like, I worked so hard for, you know, 6 months to get to that point, or five and a half months to get to that point.
Right.
And just to get a chance to go out there. Like, I really didn't know if I'd get a chance to play that year, or for that matter, ever again, because ultimately that was kind of the end of the line for me.
Right.
And just to kind of get hockey to at least come full circle and get to do a victory lap and kind of say goodbye to the game.
Yeah. Did you guys make a run?
So we did. So we ended up, we lost that first game. And then we played the next night, and I actually scored the game winner the next night. So that was a really cool feeling. The guys were pretty pumped for me then.
Yeah.
And then we won the first round in five games. Mm-hmm. And then we lost in the semifinal in seven games. So it was a bit of a heartbreaker, but I got to play 12 games. So
yeah,
I can't complain, because I was 12 more than I probably should have played that year.
Sure. Man, what an unreal story, man. That was kind of a, man, we got going here. We're hour and 20 in, and I'm like, oh my gosh, dude. That was such a good ride, dude.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Sure. Right on, man. Well, hey, what are you guys up to now? You guys are obviously back in the States.
Yeah, we are. So we got married in 2017. So in August 2017, now I work in, you know, My plan was always to work in hockey afterwards, but the more I kind of looked into it, and I did, I had a few job offers, one in college hockey as kind of like a volunteer assistant coach for one of the programs in the greater Boston area. Not Merrimack, but one of the other programs. And it was a Division I program. It would have been a really cool experience to do so, but, you know, just to make that commitment and to...
Yeah.
You know, financially, I wasn't able to make it work. And so I kind of, I don't want to say I turned the page and kind of closed the book on hockey at all. But I just, you know, I had some friends who had made the transition a year before, and they, you know, kind of pointed me in the right directions. And I looked at a couple of different fields, and I started networking to kind of see what I wanted to do. And ultimately I landed in a software sales gig, and I love it. It's definitely different than what I kind of expected to do with my life. But the majority, there are a lot of people that I work with that are, you know, former college hockey players in the area. Like, for example, my direct boss, he was a goalie. He played in the coast for a little bit, mm-hmm. and it's been really nice. Like when the people that you work with have share similar backgrounds to you, it kind of makes things, the transition, a little bit easier.
Right on. So you mentioned kind of going away from the game. Are you involved in it in any way right now?
Yep, for sure. So I still skate with some youth players in the local, you know, the greater Boston area. It's funny, I wasn't the most skilled player when I played. I was more of like a hardworking, like meat and potatoes kind of guy. It wasn't until I actually met one of my best friend's cousins, who actually is the one that was coaching that prep school that I was skating with. It was he used to train me in the summers, and he would, you know, teach me, you know, little things that would help my game specifically, and you know, stuff like edge control and things that would help me be a more dynamic player, kind of below the goal lines, which is where I spent most of my time.
Mm-hmm.
And just make me stronger on the puck, being an undersized player, like little things like that. And then he helped me with my shooting and stuff like that, so I would have a more deceptive release. Like he taught me a lot about, you know, little things that go a long way, and kind of doing less to get more out of it. And so I'm trying to pass those messages along to some of the players that I work with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because hockey players are all snowflakes, right? Everybody's different. Everybody has different skill sets.
Right.
So it's just kind of finding what works for the individual more so than kind of the grand scheme of things. So I've slowed things down and working with a few of the kids. It's fun to share just like insights and just harping on the importance of little things like playing multiple sports and, you know, having fun and, like, you know, not just focusing so narrowly on hockey at such a young age. Like, you know, he had these plans of, you know, being a 12-month hockey player and, you know, encouraging him to play lacrosse, to play football, to try different things. And not to just, you know, hockey's such a great sport. You can get so much out of it. And, you know, even here telling, you know, what, you know, a kid from Saskatchewan who ended up going to school in the greater Boston area, who ended up living in Indiana and who lived in France for a year and got to travel around. And you get so much out of hockey, but I played multiple sports growing up, and I think that everybody should. And so just to kind of share a little bit of those insights. And
Awesome. Well, Rhett, man, we appreciate so greatly you coming on and sharing your story and a bunch of other stories as well, man. You know, we miss you greatly here in Indianapolis, and I'm sure we're going to get a lot of, feedback for you to come back and tell more stories. So thanks for coming on and giving us, a little bit of insight to your career and especially the later part. You know, not a lot of us, you know, were able to read and understand kind of what was going on. So, you know, we appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always a lot of fun talking hockey, so.
Yeah, very good. All right, man. Thanks. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, guys, thanks for tuning in to Hoosier Hockey Live, brought to you by All Black Hockey Sticks. Another sponsor we'd like to say thank you to is Steiner Sports Training. Out of Indianapolis here, they have one of the best facilities for hockey training in the Midwest. Whether you like lifting weights, doing your plyometrics, pushing the sled and doing sprints that way, or getting on the hockey treadmill and enjoying that, Steiner really has everything from A to Z for your hockey game. So check out steinersportstraining.com, and they will have something for you. Another thanks to our presenting sponsor, All Black Hockey Sticks. Check out allblackhockeysticks.com. Get your stick today, customized, and shipped for under $100. So thanks again to Rhett Bly for joining us here today. And, we will be going live again here at 1 p.m., a two-episode day. You're welcome. We are going to have Carmel Ice Hounds senior forward Teddy Munn on the show. So we look forward to doing that here in a couple hours. So hang with me. We'll be back here shortly. And thanks again, Rhett, for joining us, man.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys. See ya. Hey, Rhett, thanks for coming on, brother.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, man, stay in touch. We might have to have you come on with another guy or so and, you know, maybe talk some other, you know, good indie stories. So.
Yeah, for sure.
All right.
For sure. That'd be a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thanks, buddy. We'll talk soon.
Bye.
Later.